This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, January 2nd, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Very glad to have you with us today. Well, 2018 is underway. Congress is coming back this week with the small tasks of keeping the government funded and finding an agreement on a limited but extremely controversial immigration deal involving the DACA program. The new year has rung in new protests in Iran. We'll have coverage of those marches in just a few minutes. America's first day back at work in the new year, and it's a good time to look ahead. Every year at about this time, we have our friend Ian Bremmer on the show. Ian is president and founder of the political risk consulting firm, the Eurasia Group. And every year, Ian and his company make their predictions for 10 risks for the year ahead on the global stage. Ian Bremmer is in the studio. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
And we do have this fine little tradition. Now, let's go down your list in predictions for 2018, Ian, because your first prediction is that China loves a vacuum, sort of China stepping up to a position of primacy on the world stage. And this is connected to a prediction you had last year, which is independent America, sort of this idea of America going it alone, eschewing its former multilateral relationships, and what might happen if we pursue America first.
Xi Jinping, the leader of China, has now consolidated enough power. The Chinese economy is a lot larger. And they're now, especially given Trump and given America First, much more willing to publicly say, we're prepared to be a global leader. We're prepared to take on some of those responsibilities. And, you know, I would say that so far, of all of the things Trump has managed to accomplish internationally, by far the most important is that it's provided a really profound structural opportunity for Xi Jinping and for China to play a much greater role on the global stage. And that's really going to play out in 2018.
Well, Ian, let's get a couple more predictions from you for 2018. Not all of them are pleasant, I have to say. You say that accidents between countries, poor communication could be a major risk. You also say the global tech war is becoming a cold war. What does that mean?
Well, to start with accidents, I mean, I think anyone that looks at 2018 has to feel like the headlines are making us nervous, whether it's over North Korea or Iran or the Americans and Russians and Turks operating in close military proximity without coordination in Syria, cyber conflict. I don't want to sit here and tell you one of those things is definitely going to explode in 2018. But, you know, we've been fortunate not having a major geopolitical crisis really since the Cuban Missile Crisis decades ago. In 2018, you have to feel like the likelihood of one or more of those things going badly is higher than at any point since then. And the tech war, you've got two superpowers. You've got the United States and you have China. China today has the most powerful supercomputers. They have more operational industrial robots than the United States. The size of their top two tech companies in market cap, Tencent and Alibaba, are basically as big as America's top two, means that you increasingly have two different models for technology in the global economy, and they don't play nicely with each other in 2018. I think that's going to be a real interesting challenge and risk for the global markets this year.
You predicted last year, Ian, that North Korea and its march toward nuclear weapons and missiles would be a major factor on the world scene. I think by any measure, you've proven to be correct. But I thought it was remarkable that there's not a lot about North Korea on your predictions for 2018. Do you think that the United States and South Korea and North Korea and the rest of the world have sort of reached a moment of stability where all of these tests will lead to a sort of a new normal?
This year, instead of having a specific North Korea risk, we lumped it in with these accidents in number two. So it's gone up. But frankly, there's a better shot of diplomacy in 2018 between all sides than we've probably seen in decades. And yet, the possibility that North Korea and the peninsula could end up in flames because you have a test and let's say an ICBM goes over Japanese territory and it falls and it kills some people, or you have military exercises that escalate and someone gets hurt. And between the U.S. and North Korea, you have no trust and you have more risk acceptance from the Trump administration. The chance of an accident going profoundly wrong over North Korea, as over many places, is unfortunately much greater in 2018 than we've seen in the past.
Meanwhile, you say that the opening of dialogue with Iran that was achieved through the nuclear deal, the P5+1, in the closing months of the Obama administration may fall by the wayside with the Trump administration, and that the relationship with Iran could reach a precipice.
That's right. I think it's close to a coin flip as to whether or not the Iran nuclear deal will stay intact in 2018. What we do know is even if it does, the United States is planning to take tougher economic measures against Iran separate from the nuclear deal. Now, if the U.S. is putting measures in place, even by keeping this deal intact, that Trump himself has said he's not going to certify, but he's allowing to continue for the time being, the Iranians are not seeing all those economic benefits. Hardliners in Iran certainly are going to put more pressure on the deal and may take steps that could lead that deal to fall apart. It's also conceivable that Trump, you could see him saying, that's it. Enough. This is the worst deal ever. He said that before. He blows it up. And then the Iranians start redeveloping their nuclear capabilities, at which point by the end of 2018, people are starting to talk about the potential, once again, of Israeli strikes against Iran itself.
The United Kingdom is party to those talks as well in the P5+1. And Ian, you've got some predictions about the UK. I don't know if people could have predicted Brexit and the narrow vote in the first place. But could anyone have predicted what's going on now, which is really sort of a national regret over the Brexit vote and a difficulty in finding a way to actualize this separation?
It's interesting. I mean, even though there may be regrets, those regrets are not going to lead to undoing Brexit. So 2018 is going to be a profoundly challenging diplomatic year for the UK. It's going to have negative economic consequences for their markets. And you also have the possibility of Jeremy Corbyn from the Labour Party coming into office sometime this year if Theresa May falls apart. She's very unpopular. And that would have a very negative effect, perhaps even more so than the Brexit negotiations on the UK.
Ian, we already talked a little bit about China and about North Korea. I think in this country, we have a tendency to view Asia and Asian politics as a monolith. One of your predictions says that that's not really true at all, and that identity politics in Southern Asia could become a big factor in 2018.
It's happening in a few different ways. You have anti-Chinese sentiment across Southeast Asia, where Chinese populations are increasingly economically dominant and there's backlash against them. You certainly have growing Islamism, which is picking up in part because ISIS rousted from Middle East, North Africa, moving back in some cases and having more of an impact in Southeast Asia. And there's just more radicalism picking up from disenfranchised populations. And finally, Indian nationalism that's being promoted and supported by Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India. So in all three of these cases across this part of the world, I think there's a growing story that national identities are going to become more divisive and going to lead to more conflict.
Now, you say that identity politics of a different kind could be very problematic and a major risk in Africa. Look, ISIS appears to be waning in the Middle East, but you're warning that al-Shabaab and related Islamist groups could pose a major risk in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, for a while now, there's been this hope that Africa's decade is finally here and they're going to see great growth. But there's also really lousy governance and borders are really weak and there's not much regionalism helping to integrate these communities. And you are seeing more extreme and violent forms of both Islam and in some cases Christianity. In all of those cases, that's making it harder to make a solid case for why you would want to invest in Africa long term. The interest of the United States in paying a lot for security is nowhere close to what it used to be. The Germans are talking about it, but they've got a weaker government than they've had over the last 10 years. Merkel still has to put her coalition together, of course. The French can only do so much. And the Chinese, even though they're economically dominant in many of these countries, militarily, they're still playing a very small role.
Well, Ian Bremmer, one of the things that you do that I love with your predictions is you talk about red herrings, the things that we're worried about that you say, oh, maybe not quite as big of a risk as they seem. What are a couple of those?
One we put is the Eurozone. I think there are a lot of people that have thought that Europe is ready to fall apart. But with Brexit going as badly as it has, Euroscepticism on the continent itself has been reduced. Also, the United States. The fact is that after you get tax policy done, there's not that much that's going to happen in domestic policy in the U.S.
That may be on the policy side, but wouldn't you predict the potential for some major risks domestically when it comes to scandal or just the president's willingness to continue to upend the political culture?
Well, actually, for the first time, we had listed in the risks this year the erosion of institutions, in part because of the Trump administration, though it runs much deeper than that. Many of the institutions that really form the foundation of liberal democracy in the United States are no longer what they were. And certainly the feeling that American elections are legitimate, the feelings that separation of powers really work and function, the existence of a free and open media that serves the citizens of the United States. I would argue that these things have started to erode in a way that will be hard to get them back.
Ian, before we let you go, let's do a little bit of accountability. You okay with that?
Absolutely.
Well, you definitely predicted, I think, accurately that North Korea and its missile tests and nuclear ambitions would become a major issue in 2017. You definitely predicted independent America, sort of America first, and China stepping into the breach. That's great. Where'd you get it wrong?
I think two things of our list last year that didn't come to fruition. First is an expectation that central banks were going to get more politicized. That did not happen, particularly under the Trump administration. I think to the surprise of a lot of people that, you know, you ultimately got people that were less political and more technocratic being appointed, and that Trump has largely been pretty hands off in terms of Fed policy, monetary policy. The other that I think that didn't play out, and thankfully on this one, is China overreacting. The United States-China relationship had the potential to move towards trade war. On those two, I think we didn't get it right. But I'm glad you did this because, you know, if you don't actually go back and have accountability for this stuff, there's really not much point in putting it out there.
Sure. And it's a great excuse to have you back again next year, Ian Bremmer, to find out which of these predictions for risk in 2018 you got right and you got wrong. So I hope you'll come back.
I'll be there.
Ian Bremmer, president and founder of the Eurasia Group.
This is the spot that officers tackled my father like an animal, treated his life with no respect, none.
You're hearing there the voice of activist Erica Garner, daughter of Eric Garner. Erica Garner died this weekend after a heart attack. She was 27 years old. Erica Garner became an activist after her father died in a police chokehold in the summer of 2014 in New York City. She became a prominent voice against police brutality. Here's Erica Garner on WNYC last year.
We got targets on our backs. You know, when they see a black person, they automatically think danger. They see a big black male, you know, he's a thug or he's a criminal.
Many people are mourning Erica Garner's death, and we want to hear from you. Are there leaders in your own community fighting to make life better and having an impact? Tell us who they are. Call us, 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always visit us on our Facebook page. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and you're hearing sound there from the streets in Iran, spontaneous protests that broke out last week and now have spread all over the country. Those demonstrations began in Mashhad, which is a city in the northeast of Iran. They've since spread to other cities, including Tehran. At least 20 people have been killed in clashes with government forces, including 9 overnight. These are now the largest protests since the Green Revolution marches in 2009. Trita Parsi is author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. He's also president of the National Iranian American Council. He's been talking to lots of people in Iran. Trita, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how did these latest protests get started, Trita?
Well, they got started in the city of Mashhad a couple of days ago, and ironically, it was actually started by hardliners who were trying to embarrass the current president, the more moderate president, Rouhani. But it quickly got out of control because a lot of other people joined the protests and started to change their character and turned not just against Rouhani, but against the system as a whole.
So protests that started with religious hardliners from the right, not necessarily democratic reformers, Do we know what these protests are really about now, or is it kind of a mix?
Well, as it has continued, more and more of what we're seeing are people who are out there and they're protesting, not just for the economic grievances that were some of the leading reasons for it to begin, but now increasingly targeting the regime as a whole and the system as a whole. But it's also important to understand this is a very different crowd compared to those who were protesting in 2009 in the Green Movement. This is from a different segment of society, as well as people who don't seem to have really bought into the idea that change can come from within and that it can be through gradual reform, but rather people who seem to either never have believed or lost faith in that and instead are seeking to simply overthrow the government.
Well, Trita, there seems to be a sense that these protests are truly spontaneous, but you also seem to be saying there's no real sense of who has control over where they may be going or what a strategy is here.
Certainly, we're not seeing any signs of that. Unlike the 2009 protests, there's also a clear sign that there's a bit of incitement taking place from some places outside, not necessarily foreign governments, but elements in the diaspora outside. But still, you're just not seeing the degree of organization that would make you think that there's some sort of a conspiracy going on, or that this actually can translate into some very clear objectives short of overthrowing the government.
Well, how popular is the Islamic government in Iran, Trita? You talked about the economy when we first started. Is a faltering economy really a major reason to bring people into the streets? Relief from sanctions was supposed to help an awful lot. What's the overall level of satisfaction?
The overall level of satisfaction is very, very low, and the Islamic system is not particularly popular at all. On the contrary, it's quite unpopular. But the reason why we haven't seen things like this happen is precisely because the majority of the population have tended to believe that it's better to try to achieve change peacefully within the system rather than seeking the sudden overthrow of the system. Because at the end of the day, that's what happened in 1979, in which a dictator was overthrown only to be replaced by another dictator. And it's also what we've seen happening in the Arab Spring, in which a lot of these, or in fact, almost all of the revolutions led to a worsening of the situation. So the fact that this hasn't happened in the past is not a sign that the system is popular. It's more that the population has been cautious and seeking a different way of changing it. Now we're seeing that a segment of population is coming out that seems to have lost faith in that approach and actually are pushing for something much more sudden and much more profound.
Meanwhile, the president of the United States tweeted suggesting that people in Iran were sick of their money and the economy going to terrorism. Is there evidence that that, in fact, is true? And what does it mean at this point to have statements of support coming from President Trump in this way? Does it make a difference on the ground?
I don't think anyone inside of Iran are taking their cues from Donald Trump. I mean, he remains a tremendously unpopular person inside of Iran because the policies he's been pursuing have been quite hostile to the Iranian population. Just take the Muslim ban, for instance, which has affected Iranian nationals more than any other nationality. You know, he's doing that while he's hugging the Saudis, as well as when ISIS hit Tehran, he blamed the Iranians, which is very unusual because he kind of gave a free pass to ISIS. So he's been pursuing policies that has made him very, very unpopular. That's why it's very difficult to believe that what is happening right now will, you know, cause people to listen to him or actually be inspired by what he's saying. He's most likely, you know, making it more difficult because having the support of Donald Trump in Iran is not necessarily a political plus.
Trita, let's go back inside Iran just for a moment. You've mentioned that this movement doesn't look like it's a threat to the government or is even very organized, but I would assume that there are political forces sort of waiting in the wings here, watching to see how this goes. Who are those people, and how will we know if these protests reach a point where some powerful opposition forces might try to take control of them and use it to really affect change?
There certainly are people that are trying to take advantage of the situation and are trying to essentially hijack these protests and turn it into their own. I don't think we are in anywhere near seeing that type of scenario because what is happening doesn't seem to be following anyone in particular's lead. But if we suddenly start seeing that there is an articulation of objectives that are then also mirroring what some elements on the outside are saying, as well as seeing them starting to call not just for regime change, but for a replacement of government and mentioning those elements, at that point, I think we can say, look, there actually seems to be much closer coordination with elements on the outside.
And Tarita Parsi, before we let you go, I do think it's worth asking in these situations if there's any evidence that the United States or any Western country might be helping these protests from the inside. Do you have any evidence of CIA involvement or British involvement or Western involvement in these protests?
There's always going to be speculation about that, particularly in these situations in which we have seen that in many other countries that has been the case. But thus far, at least evidence is lacking to be able to draw those conclusions.
Tarita Parsi is president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Losing an Enemy. Tarita, it's a pleasure as always.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Congress returns this week fresh-faced and optimistic for 2018. Well, maybe. More likely, ready to grind out some brutal fights on spending and immigration. In the Senate, Doug Jones will be sworn in on Wednesday, fresh off his victory over Roy Moore in Alabama. And also Tina Smith, appointed to replace Al Franken, resigning from his Minnesota Senate seat after sexual misconduct allegations. In the House, meanwhile, Speaker Paul Ryan has been singing a familiar tune lately. Paul Ryan just got $1.5 trillion in unfinanced tax cuts, and now he's ready to make up the difference, cutting Medicare and Social Security. Well, maybe.
So we're going to have to get back next year at entitlement reform, which is how you tackle the debt and the deficit.
What exactly does Paul Ryan mean by entitlement reform here? Does he have the juice in a divided Republican Congress to cut Medicare and Social Security? Sunmin Kim is a Senate reporter for Politico.
We'll see if the speaker gives us more details earlier this year. He and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, along with President Donald Trump, are scheduled to meet at Camp David this weekend to sketch out their 2018 legislative agenda. But it's pretty clear that if he means entitlement reform, as in these health care programs, that the Senate, led by McConnell, but also backed up by a lot of his rank and file, are really ready to say no way pretty quickly on. So that's something that they're going to have to resolve at this upcoming retreat this weekend.
You said the Senate wouldn't be into it, Sungmin. The president, during the campaign, said, I'm not going to touch Medicare and Social Security. Now, we're sort of used to Donald Trump maybe not sticking to those pronouncements, but he said it pretty clearly.
He did say it pretty clearly, which is the other major hurdle here. So you have a president who had made this campaign pledge not to touch these programs. You have a Senate who is about to lose a one Republican member as of tomorrow when Alabama Senator-elect Doug Jones is sworn in. That gives the Senate a 51-49 margin, which is almost nothing at this point. We saw how difficult it was for Republicans to corral 50 votes around their effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. If it was that hard when you had two votes you could lose, imagine how difficult it would be when you can have just one.
But let's talk about what Republicans might actually be able to cut here, Sungmin, because some people have warned that maybe Paul Ryan rhetorically says, yeah, we're going to shoot for the moon. We're going to do Social Security reform and Medicare reform. That might not work, but in the end, he might be able to get Plan B, which is some pretty significant cuts to programs for poor people, like food stamps and welfare.
Again, even those reforms collide against the general message of McConnell heading into 2018, which he sketched out for us at his year-end press conference. And his theme is bipartisanship. He acknowledged that 2017 had been a very partisan year, with Republicans using these Republican-only legislative tactics on healthcare and on tax reform. But McConnell wants that to change in 2018 because of the midterm elections. So McConnell is talking up things like infrastructure, which could be an area of bipartisan cooperation. A lot of his rank and file members also talk that up. The White House is supposed to release a plan soon, and whether that outlines of a plan is enough to get Democrats on board, we'll be watching that in the coming weeks. Another major item that is immediately on the Congress's agenda right now is immigration and the fate of these young undocumented immigrants who came here as minors. McConnell also knows that that is also inherently a bipartisan task. And he's looking at this group of seven senators from both sides of the aisle to come up with a deal that can hopefully get 60 votes in the Senate. So anything that's super sharply partisan, even McConnell is really veering away from, which I think is interesting. There are some Republican members who want another shot to repeal Obamacare, repeal the Affordable Care Act. And McConnell has even said it's time to move on. He wants this year, tone-wise, to be very different than 2017.
Seungmin Kim, Senate reporter for Politico. A pleasure, as always. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Minimum wage!
Minimum wage workers in 18 states started the new year with a boost in pay this year. The increases will impact an estimated 4.5 million workers across the country. David Cooper is here. He's senior economic analyst at the Economic Policy Institute because different rules are affecting different cities in 18 different states. David, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how significant are these raises for individuals across the 18 states? Where are we seeing the biggest jumps?
Well, the largest jump happens in Maine, where workers there are getting an additional dollar per hour in their hourly wages. So for someone who works full-time year-round, that's about an additional $2,000 in their annual income. And for someone who's only making minimum wage, an additional $2,000 is a pretty significant increase in their spending power. That's going to really raise their living standards a little bit.
So Maine gets a dollar jump for minimum wage workers. That's a pretty big increase. Other places where maybe 50 cents, 75 cents, a more gradual but significant increase in the minimum wage?
Yeah, I mean, California has a 50 cent increase. Colorado has a 90 cent increase. These are folks who are only making $9, $10 an hour. So even an additional 50 cents per hour, if they're working full time or close to full time, you know, that's a pretty sizable increase in their spending power. That's the difference between being able to afford a new car payment, being able to pay the rent, whatever it may be, being able to afford even tuition payments for folks who may be trying to go to school.
So how does this look in the overall economic picture, David? We've seen an enormous amount of movement of capital up the income scale to the top over the last two decades, while middle class wages have stagnated. With the minimum wage, we're even talking about the bottom of the middle class or usually the working poor. What does this really mean to the economy?
Well, for the folks that it impacts, it's a significant increase. It's about $5 billion, we estimate, in additional wages going to the affected workers over the course of next year. And again, $5 billion to the lowest paid workers in the economy is a significant chunk of change for them. In terms of the broader economy, you know, it's not really going to change the overall trends that we've seen over the last 40 years, namely that wages for most workers have basically stagnated while the top has sort of pulled away from everyone else. But at least it is movement at the bottom. And when we look at what's happened to hourly wages over the last few years, some of the strongest growth in hourly wages has actually been at the bottom of the wage distribution. And we can point to these minimum wage increases, as well as the steadily improving economy and the improving labor market, to really having that impact, to really driving that increase in hourly wages for workers at the bottom.
So, David, what places, what cities and states are you keeping an eye on now? We had reports from Seattle earlier in the year when a move to drastically increase the minimum wage there appeared to some analysts to have the opposite of the desired effect. It started to influence employers to cut hours or not hire at the bottom of the pay scale. So do we know any more now about where the sweet spot is between maximum wages without hurting employment?
Yeah, so this is the question that always comes up every time folks talk about raising the minimum wage, is what's the effect going to be on employment? And it's probably the most studied topic in labor economics. As you mentioned, there was a study that came out earlier this year. There's actually two studies that came out not too long ago looking at Seattle. And these two studies had sort of competing takes on what was happening there. One of them, produced by the University of Washington, seemed to indicate that the increase, not all the way to 15, but just going up to $13 an hour, seemed to have these large negative effects on employment in the city. The other study was by the University of California, Berkeley, which seemed to find no effect on employment in the city. And there's reasons to be skeptical of the University of Washington study that I won't necessarily go into, but I think the broad takeaway is that economists are still trying to identify that sweet spot. They're still trying to understand, you know, how high we can push the minimum wage before it starts to have sizable negative effects, because the truth is we haven't seen that happen over the last 30 years. As I said, this is probably the most studied topic in labor economics, and the overwhelming conclusion of the research we've done since the 1990s as states started raising their minimum wages above the federal minimum wage is that at least all of the increases that we've done in minimum wages since then, we've never seen the sort of sizable negative impacts that some of the textbook models would predict. The increases in minimum wages have had their desired effects, namely raising low-wage workers' paychecks with little to no effect on their employment.
David Cooper, Senior Economic Analyst with the Economic Policy Institute. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
Thanks for being with us on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick, and let's go to California now, where as of yesterday, recreational non-medical marijuana is now legal for the first time. The new law in California means that some people previously convicted of marijuana offenses could have their sentences cut or their records cleared entirely. Hundreds of thousands of people across the state could be eligible. Summer Steffen is the San Diego County District Attorney. She joins me now on what the new law means for people with prior marijuana convictions and what's now allowed in California.
They can possess up to 1 ounce of marijuana or up to 8 grams of marijuana concentrates. They can also share it, and they can grow up to 6 plants that are out of public view. Buying and selling is a misdemeanor crime unless you're regulated, like in a dispensary, and you've gotten your proper licenses so that folks can have the safe access that was intended by the act.
Now, another aspect of this legal change, Summer Steffen, is retroactive expungement. Some people call it restorative justice. Thousands of people across California with prior marijuana convictions who might be able to have those convictions overturned. Who are those people?
In San Diego County, our office has one of the most sophisticated tracking of conviction systems. We took a jump start and created a list. So San Diego is a little ahead of other regions in that we have about 650 defendants that have now received some sort of restorative justice, where if we're looking at them as if they had committed the offense currently, because the law allows retroactive application. We kind of made their convictions misdemeanors and cleared their records otherwise as the law gives authority. We have about 50 individuals that were actually in custody. With some, there would be probation. With others, it was basically just get out of jail and no other consequences.
Good news for them. Could you describe one example, maybe what kind of person who was an offender before under the law might find their record expunged now? I don't know, somebody who might have sold a pound or two of marijuana, might have caught a felony a couple of years ago, now can find that they're free to go.
We had a young 23-year-old who sold to undercover police officers about $300 worth of marijuana. So with him, his felony record was reduced to a misdemeanor. In his case, it was really good news because he had no other convictions. And so hopefully this will help him get a job and be able to vote, other things that folks without felony records would have. Other kind of a little more extreme cases really qualify under this law. For example, and I'm not sure the citizens wanted this to qualify, but somebody who transported about 250 pounds worth of marijuana. So that's quite substantial. But under the law, they were allowed to reduce that felony conviction to a misdemeanor.
A legal change, and I know your job is to help enforce the law, that's supposed to keep small-time recreational users out of the criminal justice system, is now applying to somebody who is transporting 250 pounds. It sounds like, you know, from your experience, that person might not be casual.
That is a lot of pounds of marijuana, but, you know, we are supposed to execute the will of the people while trying to maintain public safety. So wherever people are eligible to benefit under the law, then we do that. You know, we've set a really good example of being able to give the people what they wanted and do it expeditiously, not drag our feet, because that's not what ethical prosecutors need to be doing.
And do you suspect that other counties, other regions in California are as far ahead as you are? I can imagine there might still be thousands of people going about their lives in your state who either weren't aware of this change or don't know how to access the benefits.
I think there probably are. We're looking at in San Diego County about another 6,000 that we're going to work through their convictions, but fortunately none that are facing immediate consequences in terms of being in prison or jail.
You and your office worked hard to put away some of these people, not just because of the law, but because I assume you felt like they had to go away or they had to be convicted. The law has changed, but do you have any misgivings about some of the people who will either be set free or who will have their records reduced because California has changed the law here?
It's a little bit relative for us because San Diego is such a progressive county. We are one of the safest urban counties anywhere in the United States. We embraced all sorts of reentry and restorative justice programs ahead of this proposition. So it's not a shocking change for us, but there are certain things that we have to keep an eye on. You know, we are one of the largest border entry gateways. So we have, you know, Mexico as our neighbor, and there are some very, very active drug cartels that bring marijuana and other drugs, fentanyl lately, into our county. So what we want to make sure is that the goal of this proposition is to make sure that there is less of a black market. So we have a big job to do in terms of public safety, but we're prepared to protect our community as best as we can while providing the full intent of the law.
Summer Steffen, District Attorney in San Diego County. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway. For the last month or so, we've been bringing you weekly conversations with two editors at the center of covering women as the Me Too movement gained momentum across America.
Hi, I'm Koa Beck. I'm the new editor-in-chief of Jezebel.
And I'm Jessica Bennett. I am the equally new gender editor at the New York Times.
Koa and Jessica have talked about how to cover the Me Too movement responsibly and journalistically. They've offered their own takes on the stories and revelations pouring out in industry after industry. And now for the new year, Koa and Jessica look ahead and share what they're looking for in 2018 in covering women and harassment and workplace culture.
I hope very strongly that this continues and that there are more stories and more people who want to speak about this. What I'm also hoping for, though, is a halting on this sort of performative firing that we're seeing, too, where now the formula is going a different direction where outlets are hearing about reporting or long investigative features about a top man in a certain industry. And so they just fire him. And I see the optics. I don't see a truthful caring about women, because all of these reports, one of the things they all have in common is that a lot of people knew. Some of them have HR trails, not all of them, but everybody knew. And so I think once again, we're seeing a narrative in which people allegedly care about women, but really it's just about protecting their bottom line and looking like they care and fit in with a moment. And that concerns me.
It's like the larger problem is the system that allowed for it.
Right.
And in some of these cases, there haven't even been full investigations done.
No. No. Which also concerns me on some level, that they just want to fire without addressing the actual problem.
Right. So, Koa, as we, you know, head into sort of the next stage of this news cycle, do you worry that there will be a backlash at all?
The backlash that I am concerned about is what I have discussed internally with my staff as the Mike Pence backlash. Mm-hmm. This is very, very specific to professional women who have access to certain opportunities, in that I personally found the threshold between, look, all these women are being violated, to, oh my God, we can't have holiday parties. We clearly can't mentor women one-on-one. Mm-hmm. We clearly need to keep women away from opportunity, basically. And this very, you know, Mike Pence sort of rule of like, I don't dine with anyone, you know, any woman without my wife present. That concerns me because that is just going to stifle women's ambition. It's going to stifle women's opportunity. We're not going to see women in any of these slots where men have been fired. And I mean, you can cut that a lot of different ways. But a lot of quotes that I have seen across the New York Times and other outlets where spokespeople say this, I mean, these are men who all likely identify as capital L liberal. I mean, these aren't conservative pockets of the country. This is Silicon Valley being like, well, I guess, you know, we can't have women in these fields anymore. And that is the backlash that concerns me, because I think the takeaway from this shouldn't be men and women can't be together.
A friend was telling me a story about a lawsuit in the 90s, I think it was. And it was an EEOC complaint by women in a company. It was a tech company. And part of the solution on behalf of the male-run tech company was to build a literal wall in the office so that the women worked on one side and the men worked on the other.
Sounds like Gilead in The Handmaid's Tale.
It's absurd. So, I mean, we know already that women have less mentorship opportunities. Like, What we know, if you follow this, mentorship and sponsorship is absolutely key and crucial to a woman's success at work, to anyone's mm-hmm. success at work. Women have less of them. In part, that is because there are less senior women already. It is also because something like 2/3 of men are afraid that if they mentor a woman one-on-one, it will be perceived as inappropriate mm-hmm. in some manner. So that's mm-hmm. already a fear. And now we have this. So I think we need to keep pushing back against that, because quite honestly, you're going to know if you're harassing someone. The line is not that fine. Actually, I think Jezebel is where I saw this piece about how Vox had, in fact, there was no open bar allowed at their holiday party. Instead, they were offering drink tickets. And Jezebel's brilliant response was, hey, maybe you should just have no open bar for the guys.
Do you see how just narratives like that, I mean, they are a hop, skip, and a jump away from the, you know, don't drink on college campus to prevent rape.
Right.
This, all avenues lead to that.
I guess what I hope for 2018, for this year, in terms of coverage of this is, you know, I think it's so important to continue to break these stories. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important that we move a bit away from the celebrities and focus on the regular women who are dealing with this every day, whether that is blue-collar women, working-class women, those who may not have the capacity to speak up or the ability to know who to go to in the media in order to facilitate that. So I hope that that is a focus. I also hope we turn to solutions. These men continue to fall like dominoes. In some cases, as Koa was saying, it seems to almost be preventative by these organizations before a full investigation is even done. Like it's optics, it's PR, more so than changing the actual systems and structures. And what we know, I mean, what academics know is that sexual harassment trainings don't work very well. Mm-hmm. So like, okay, what does work and how can we start talking about that? Like mm-hmm. bystander intervention is one thing that has been found to be very successful and is actually sort of obvious. Like I feel like bystander intervention is basically like, if you see something screwed up happening, jump in and prevent it. But we don't do it.
Right.
And so talking about that openly and figuring out ways that we can, you know, maybe that's one thing. But I don't know. Do you know any solutions that I don't, Koa?
A broader solution that I would like to see in light of this news cycle. There are a number of, you know, career books for women. Jessica wrote one of them that I have read and have valued at different points in my career. Clearly, while those have contributed to discussions on how women can excel in the workplace, we are the people who don't necessarily, as women and other marginalized genders, need
more advice.
Yeah. We don't need more advice. We need lean in for men.
Yep.
That's like,
or perhaps lean out.
Lean out. Lean out. Yeah. Lean out and don't touch me. New York Times bestseller.
Amen.
And so one of the things that I can at times find frustrating about news cycles that can be dominated by certain sort of career-bolstering books for women is that they can at times frame it as like you're not doing enough.
Mm-hmm.
I see that in certain reporting that I have done and read, particularly with regard to how certain businesses are structured. But if there's one thing this news cycle has made abundantly clear, it's that women should not and cannot be held accountable for their professional success when there are literally rapists and sexual harassers in the room preventing them from exceeding beyond a certain point.
Kawa Beck there, editor-in-chief of Jezebel and author of fiction, and also Jessica Bennett, gender editor for the New York Times and author of Feminist Fight Club. You can find all of Kawa and Jessica's conversations about this Me Too movement on our website at thetakeaway.org. Well, that's our show. If you missed it, though, check out our New Year's Day show about artificial intelligence. There's a lot on the ethics of AI, including how Siri responds to language that humans might consider harassment.
It turns out that if I said you're hot 8 times in a row to Siri, she finally stopped saying she was blushing and oohing and aahing, and she said stop, flat out.
Find that at thetakeaway.org. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language, like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel. BABBEL.com.
By Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device designed to reward safe drivers. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive. And Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.